This is an Our Savior Evangelical Free Church podcast. To learn more, visit osefc.org.
As they go, I would invite you in here to join me in 1 Kings chapter 18. 1 Kings chapter 18, there are two books of Kings in the Old Testament. They're probably about half-ish way through the Old Testament, so maybe one-third into your Bible, a little bit less than that. And while you are turning to 1 Kings chapter 18, I want to tell you about a rude wake-up that I had a long time ago. I was in Istanbul, Turkey, my first time there, and I woke up to the sound of loud music and words blaring over loudspeakers all over the city. Now, we had gotten in to our hotel late in the evening, and so I hadn't heard anything like this. And so as I was startled awake, what I was hearing is the morning call to prayer that they blast from giant speakers that are usually lifted high up above most of the buildings in a spire or a minaret, and they five times a day call people in predominantly Muslim nations to prayer. And all over the city, not everybody, because not everybody in a place like that is as devout as others, but people will stop what they're doing, they'll face toward Mecca, and they'll perform the rituals and say the words along with the prayers. And that was my first time in a place like that, hearing, seeing, reacting to something like that. In fact, I had never been in a place that was so inundated, in fact, by its religious context. And so I was processing a lot. Two or three days later, was still thinking a lot about that, and I was talking with some friends, and I'd sort of come to this conclusion. I said, you know, I wonder if all religions are not basically the same. I would think that that means there probably is a God, but maybe he's the same for all of the religions. You know, there are different people in the world. It's a diverse place. So maybe all these various religions are just different interpretations of, you know, one God. And now, if you've thought that, if you think that, you know somebody who thinks that, it sounds on the surface intellectually curious and open-minded. But the problem is that kind of conclusion that I was reaching in Istanbul, this was much, much more than 20 years ago, is just simply impossible. It cannot be true. And I'll tell you why. More importantly than me telling you why, 1 Kings 18 is going to tell us why together here in a few minutes. But the reason that that can't be true, that there can't be various expressions among different religions of only one God, is because all of them not only are so wildly different, but there is only one true God. He's only revealed himself in certain and specific ways, and there is only one way to know the one true God. And so, if you want to look around and say, I think this is all the same expression, a different expression of the same thing, you can't do that if you want to be true and honest at all. And I'll tell you this, because I've spent my life doing it. And I challenge you to do the same. The more you study religion or faith or belief, and when you take those things honestly, at face value, when you follow them through to their logical ends and conclusions. In other words, when you say, where does this way of believing, where does this faith, where does this religious system ultimately take me? The more you do that, you will see that they can't all be the same. And really and truly, there is only one that leads to life. The rest will only lead to your downfall and your death. And this is what is happening for the people Elijah is among. And it's still happening today. This isn't so very different from where we find ourselves. Last week, if you were here, I spent a lot of time sort of expounding on and laying open the world of Elijah. If you didn't hear that, it really is worth going back and listening to it to help you sort of cover the next couple months with a framework and a context. But because of the sake of time, I'm not going to rehash all of that and repeat it this morning. So I'll simply say this to set the mood and to set the scene. Elijah's time is very similar to ours. He lived in a time and in a place where people were very confused about who God is and where they should put their belief. But even in the midst of that confusion, he managed to live with a clear faith, a clear understanding of who God is and where he should place his hope and put his belief. And I think what you're going to say is, and what we'll see from Elijah is God richly rewarded him for that. But that is not what happens to Elijah. Most of his life is actually very hard. But even that, though, shows us plenty. We can learn from men and women who have displayed real faith in the midst of confused times, and we can learn so much from them because they're like us. And this is what we learn from Elijah. His whole life is that knowing God, the true God, and being faithful to him has far more to do with getting at the real stuff of life than you'll ever find by getting swept away by kind of the river that runs through our culture. It's easy to get swept up in the trappings of the world around you. It's easy to fall away and to move away from faith in the living God. Elijah shows us how to anchor ourselves in him. And what we're going to see this morning is in this really, really powerful story, it's God alone who can come into our lives with power and change everything about us. It's God alone who can come into our lives with fire. And though it may be dramatic and even difficult at times, ultimately it's the only thing that will ever save us. Now, I want to kind of handle one other objection before we get into this, and you'll see why. When I say we have to make decisions about what we worship, when I say you have to follow God to live, you can't get swept away with the world, there's a lot of people, maybe even in here, there's a lot of people you know that will say, well, I might not be following God decisively, but I'm certainly not getting swept away with the rest of the world. You know, you might just kind of say, well, I'm not all in with God, but I'm not rejecting him outright. Here's what Elijah, this very important prophet of God, in fact, as you read in the Old Testament and then into the New Testament, what you'll often find the people of God concluding is that Moses stands for the law of God and Elijah represents the prophet of God, the prophets of God. You'll hear people talk about the law and the prophets. What they're often referring to is what Moses said and what Elijah said. Elijah's among the people that God revered. In the time of Jesus, it was Moses and then it was Elijah. So he's a big deal. And Elijah, this great man of God, this great spiritual sage, would say you have to make a decision. And if you don't think, either you have to make one, or if you're not sure if you have, then that's a decision already in itself. You either have to be all in with God, or you will get swept into the river of the world. And we're going to see that. Elijah will lay that out. The story just kind of unfolds in three parts. The first is Elijah saying, let's just get this out in the open. And so what he's going to do is he's going to say there's two gods that you think you might want to worship. The false god, it's called Baal. The queen loved him. The king had dabbled with Baal. And so Elijah says in this first part, let's have a contest. Let's really get after it. Let's set up a competition to see who the real God is. And so let's read this. We're not going to read every verse this morning, but we're going to read what I think will help us to understand the flow of this. Let's go to verse 21. 1 Kings 18. Follow along while I read from 21. And Elijah came near to all the people and said, how long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. And the people did not answer him a word. Remember that. They didn't answer him a word. Then Elijah said to the people, I only am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Let two bulls be given to us, and let them choose one bull for themselves and cut it in pieces and lay it on the wood, but put no fire to it. And I will prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood and put no fire to it. And you call upon the name of your God, and I will call upon the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, he is God. And all the people answered, it is well spoken. In other words, there we go. That's a good idea. So we'll stop there for a minute. Elijah's initial question is not only the right one to ask, but it's really, really telling. So there's a lot of words. Depending on what translation you have of the Bible, this portion of the Bible was originally written in Hebrew. We've translated it into English, and you can take a bunch of different techniques when you do that. So depending on what translation you would have, when you read verse 21, your question will read something like this. We read, how long will you go limping between gods? If you have the NIV, you'll read, how long will you waver between gods? If you have the New American Standard, it will say, how long will you hesitate? Now, all of those are fine translations, but the latter couple miss something that I think the ESV, which is what we have in our pews and what I read from, I think it has it right here. Not only because of the word limp, which is a very accurate translation, but because if you translate it with limp in 21, what you'll see is a key connection in verse 26. And so what happens next is the prophets of Baal, they take their turn first. So they set up the altar and they begin to call on Baal, but they get no answer. I told you to remember that. It comes up a lot. They get no answer. And then it says that they do this. They do it for 6 hours. They're calling on him. And it says at the end of that 6 hours, they limped around the altar. Now, isn't that a strange way? How long will you go limping? 21. And they were limping. They limped around the altar in 26. What's the connection? What's the author trying to say through it? The author is saying the people gathered, all of them, not just the prophets of Baal, not just the king, not just the queen, all these people, and there are probably thousands here. They've chosen Baal. They've come to watch, and the indication is they expect to see Baal win. So they are wavering, but remember, Elijah is going to tell us, if you're wavering, you've already made your choice. You've either chosen God, but if you haven't chosen him, you've rejected him. The people are limping because they've wavered. The people are limping because they've hesitated, and that is the choice in itself. And it's a good word because this is what idolatry does to you. It cripples you. Many times before this, and this is intentional. The Bible, words are always intentional in the Bible. The word of God is way too clever to have mistakes like this. Many times throughout the scriptures, when it comes to the worship of God, it will say, David danced with joy before the Lord, or something like that. Here, they limp around Baal because what he has brought into their lives, what their worship of this false god has brought into their lives, has hobbled them. Literally, it's crippled them. It's brought drought and subsequent famine. It's brought suffering. The whole land has been affected by this idolatry. And this is what idol worship does. It takes your strength, and it takes your freedom, and it takes your very life, and it sucks it from you. It takes your vitality, and it draws it out of you. False worship does two things. First, it confuses you on the way to blinding you. And then second, false worship sets you up for failure. Now, I'll just briefly show you how. We don't have a lot of time for this, but let's just take, we'll take the calls to prayer that I heard in Istanbul. All over the city, people are stopping. They're rolling out a small mat that they carried with them. They're laying down on it. They're moving the way they're taught. They're saying what they were told to say. They're going through all this five times a day. And for what? Why are they doing this? They've been told, if you do this, your God will be pleased with you. But here's the trap. Another prayer time is always coming. In just a few short hours, you're going to have to do this again to please your God. And then tomorrow, you're going to have to do it five more times. And the day after that, and the day after that. And here's the other thing. Even if you do all the prayers, there's still other pillars of this religion to do. And you have to do those to be better. You have to do those to achieve. This is what idol worship does. It just never ends. False gods always need to be paid off. False gods always needed to be placated over and over and over again. And you might say, well, that's not me. I'm not a Muslim. In fact, I don't think I'm just doing it right now. In the context of Islam, we don't need to decide. You know, you might say, well, let's just let people choose for themselves. What if they want to do that? The trouble there is now you're not only confused, and I said false worship always leads to just outright confusion, because you're not only confused, but what happens when you want to allow for religious pluralism, when you want to just say, who am I to decide for others? You know, I'm not even sure we can know what's right. What you've done is you've set up a system that nobody can possibly keep up with. And you've kind of put yourself in the place of God, and here's why. So this is what happens. You can't go on thinking that all gods are the same or equal. That doesn't work. And the reason is that that belief indirectly makes you God. And here's what I mean by that. If you say you don't have to choose between religions, they're all good, they're all fine, they all have their merits, and then you meet people who are actually proponents of those faiths, I mean, real proponents, because it's not just Christians. Muslims will believe this. Jewish people will believe this. Hindus will believe this. They'll all tell you they're right. Strict proponents of all faiths and all religions will tell you they're right. And there is plenty within those that are so defiantly different that when you take them, remember I said to their logical end, to the end of what they believe, they will always, always show you just how distinct they are. And for you to say, well, who can know? And maybe they're all just kind of the same. Well, what you've done is you've put yourself into the place of God. Now you're the one who's telling people what true faith is. Now you're the one telling people what's right and what's wrong. If you said, well, I'm so open, you have to tell somebody, well, if I'm the open one and I'm the right one, then you're the wrong one. And to tell somebody who's right and wrong, you've now made yourself God over their life. And you'll always fail when that happens. Because there's only one person who's truly meant to do that, and that's the real God. That's the living God. There is a true God, and there are many false ones. Before you say, well, I'll give you one more. If you're kind of skeptical and you say, well, aren't you just right now? Adam, aren't you just doing the same thing with me right now? I will readily admit, yes, I am making truth claims. But mine are not based on my word. Mine are based on his words. Mine are based on the word of God. And so if your qualm is with the truth claims of Christianity, it is not with me. My role is to simply hold them out for you. To do that here, to do that from all the scriptures. And so if you want to argue against the truth claims of Christianity, you're going to have to argue against the Bible. You don't have to argue against me. I'm nobody. God's everything. So you have to argue against me. So this is the context. We'll see how the rest of it unfolds. But before we, but kind of as we do that, let's move into how these false gods fail. When their God doesn't answer, remember, he gave no answer. This is what they do. Look at verse 28. And they cried aloud and cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. And as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation, but there was no voice. No one answered. No one paid attention. So you see what they're doing here? Again, you might be saying to all of this, listen, I might not be a Christian, but I'm not a Muslim. Maybe there's a number of people here who would just say, I'm not anything. Maybe I'm agnostic. I'm an atheist. I don't even have a God. So where am I in this? These are a bunch of God worshipers. The right one, the wrong one, who can know? I don't worship any God. I just sort of believe in a set of spirituality, or I believe in a set of principles, but none of these gods is for me. Well, here's the issue. Here's where you are in this story. You're among the Baal worshipers. You have to know that you're among the Baal worshipers. And here's the reason. Baal isn't answering. Of course he's not. He's not real. It's not, there isn't a Baal someplace that's just less than God. Baal isn't real. And so if you say, I don't have a God, you're a Baal worshiper. You're worshiping nothing. They're worshiping nothing. You're worshiping nothing. Which is actually impossible, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But if you want to know where you are, if you don't think you have a God, this is where you are. You're functionally in the exact same place as these people. So look at what they do, because you'll see what you might do. They limp around. They cry. They cut themselves. They're shedding their blood for this God. What are they doing? They're performing for him. They're doing what they think they should or they must to earn what they think he can give. In this case, it's rain. There's been a drought. We do the same thing for whatever we think our God is. I worked long hours, harder than anybody else around here. I deserved that promotion. We even use phrases like, I put my blood, sweat, and tears into this place. And I got overlooked. What did I do that for? Nothing. I deserved it. Or we say, I followed the rules. I did everything right, but look at, I've been left behind, and look at that person. I know that she lied to get ahead, but she didn't suffer any consequences for it. I did everything right. I deserve better than the liar. Or we say, we served, we gave, we sacrificed. They didn't do that, and look, now they have their health, and look at me. Where they seem happy, I'm not. One of the hardest ones. I did what I was supposed to do as a parent, and my kids didn't turn out the way that I wanted them to. I performed. I danced. I went to the point of shedding my own blood, and I didn't get the answer that I wanted. This is what happens. False gods, they never really do, but even if we think they did at one point, they stop answering. You can call or perform, do what you're supposed to do. But the reason they won't is because there's nobody there to answer. There's nobody there to hear you. Only the living God can hear you and respond. Because he's the only one that's real. The catch is that if you call on him, if you have real faith, you don't get to decide when he answers or what he says. Again, that just means you're God. So that's the check. If he's only God to you, if he responds on your timetable, and he says the right thing back to you, then he's really no God at all. He's there for you. And the true and living God is not served, is not there to serve you. He is there to be glorified among you. But Christians, if we can wait on him, if we can receive his word, and he can teach us to follow him and live with him, he will defeat false gods in our lives, and he will show himself to be more true and more faithful, more just, more righteous, and better than anything else this world could ever have to offer. I'll show you how he does it here, because it shows us how he does it really everywhere. And this is really something to learn. So the true God is about to triumph, because now it's Elijah's turn. He gets a sacrifice set up, and what he does, just to make sure there's no doubt, is he asks for 3 rounds. He asks for huge jugs of water to be brought, and he says, pour it all over the altar. There's so much water that gets poured on the altar. It gets poured on the bull that's been cut up. It's been poured on the wood, so the wood is soaked. There's so much water that there's been a trench or a trough around the altar dug, and the trough is full of water. Everything is just soaking wet. Nobody is going to say, well, you got lucky. You know, it was kind of dry out. Spontaneous combustion is possible. Now, everything is soaked to the core. Even the rocks are soaking wet. I want to read in 36. Let's start in verse 36. At the time of the offering of the oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and said, O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. What he's doing is he's reminding the people of who they are, their history, who has been their true God. Let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I have done all the things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me. Remember, when Elijah asked the people how long they're going to limp or waver between Baal and Jehovah, our God, they didn't answer. When they called on bail, he didn't answer. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. Verse 39, and when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. I want to ask some really key questions. So right here, it's obvious. I don't need to tell you the Lord is glorious. The people now see it. God's been vindicated. Here's my question, though. There are so many ways that God could have done this. And the story seems over. It seems like, okay, it's over, done with, we've settled it. But there are two points that have always bothered me about this story. The first is that earlier, God has already said he's going to bring rain. So if you go back, and we're going to do this next week. We're going to be in verse 18. We're going to kind of read the bridge. This is the middle. We're going to do the ends of the bridge next week. God has already said he's going to bring rain. 3.5 years, there's been drought. It's going to come to an end. So if God's already said, I'm going to bring rain, why did this need to happen first? I think the answer to that one is pretty straightforward. There can't be any confusion about where rain is going to come from. Rain comes from God. Provision comes from God. But if it just started to rain, it almost certainly wouldn't have been enough for the people. They were so steeped, limping so significantly that they would have just said, well, it's because of Baal. Baal brought us the rain. Or, even if Baal didn't, what difference does it make? Apparently, we weren't that bad off because the rain finally came. It's one of the things we learn about faith in here. You know, we as a people are not good at subtlety. We kind of need fire or we don't get it. Is that not sort of true? There are so many times where God is kind and gracious, and he comes to us. But we say, well, that turned out well because I worked hard. That went my way because I had a good plan. I was prudent. I saved. Have you ever asked, God, why won't you just speak to me with a sign? Why won't you just show me something big? I mean, honestly, isn't there some of us who'd like this? I want fire. I want fire from heaven right down where I want it, when I want it. And you're thinking, but God's never given it to me. Folks, I've got good news. He has. He has given you fire from heaven. And you'll say, well, metaphorically, maybe, right? Because I've never seen it. And I'd say, yeah, kind of metaphorically, but not really. As much as he could do this for you, and he still could, he's not done this just by telling you about it with Elijah. He's done it in a much more profound and a much more significant way. He's giving you something better than fire from heaven. He's giving all of us something better from heaven. So the second thing that's always kind of bothered me about this time is the fire itself. Why? I've always wondered, why does the fire go on the sacrifice? Have you ever asked that question? Read the story? You know, this is the one where you probably heard it. Elijah actually taunts the prophets of Baal, and he says, you know, maybe he's away. Maybe he's gone on a journey. He actually says, maybe he's in the bathroom. You know, he does all, he's taunting them. And then the prophets of Baal are doing all these things. They're idolatrous. They're wicked idolatrous. They've poisoned Israel. They've led Israel away from God. Why does the fire go on the sacrifice? Shouldn't the fire go on the prophets of Baal? You'd say, well, God, shouldn't God destroy Baal? Again, he's not real. There's nothing to destroy. Shouldn't he destroy the worshipers? In fact, I left one verse out on purpose. We read to 39. If you read to 40, Elijah commands that all the prophets be taken down to this brook, and they're all slaughtered there. They're all destroyed. They're all killed. Why that way? Why doesn't the fire fall on the prophets? Why the sacrifice? Wouldn't it have been a more powerful sign to bring it down, not on the sacrifice, but on the prophets? And the answer is no, it wouldn't. It's much more powerful, and God is much more fully revealed in who he is, what his heart is like, and what he's ultimately doing, that the fire comes to the sacrifice. In the New Testament Gospel of Luke, chapter 9, Jesus is going through a place, and people are not receiving him there, meaning they're not honoring him, they're not worshiping him as they should. And so the disciples in Luke 9:54 ask if they should try to call down fire on the people for this. I think they're thinking of this story. Should we be like Elijah and call down the righteous fire that proves who you are, Jesus? What Jesus says there, though, is no. And it says he rebukes them. What the disciples don't get, this is how Tim Keller says it, and I love this, is Jesus isn't Elijah in this story. He's not the one calling down fire. Jesus is the bull on the altar being sacrificed. That's where Jesus is in this story. He is the one who will willingly go to the cross, endure the torment of his own Father justly against sin, so that other people can have their life. The whole of Israel deserved to die for their worship of Baal. But instead, God directs the fire into the sacrifice. Listen to how Jesus will describe what the cross is just a few chapters on from that in Luke 12. This is Luke 12:49. I came to cast fire on the earth, and that it were already kindled. I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how great is my distress until it is accomplished. Do you think that I've come to give peace on earth? No, I tell you, but rather division. He describes the cross as fire because stories like this are in the Old Testament. This is what he wants people to think of. The sin of idolatry deserves a consuming fire from a holy God. And Jesus is saying, we're going to get that, but it's going to go onto me and not onto you. So I will absorb the fire as the sacrifice, and you will get to go free and live your life. So this is what we see from the story. The Lord comes with fire because he's holy, and he does. But he's also the one who endures the fire because he's gracious. There are all sorts of connections here. So remember at the end, the people say, you know, surely now he's God. After they see what God did with the fire. Do you remember when Jesus died on the cross? The end of Mark's gospel. And there's a Roman guard there and he watched the way that Jesus died. His response is so similar. He says, surely he was the Son of God. People always want to find Jesus in the powerful stories of the Old Testament. But often that's not where he is. He's the lamb for slaughter in the Passover. He's the bull for sacrifice. He's the one provided so that Abraham's son can live. And he's the only one that can do that. Every other god says, do this for me. Dance for me. Cut yourself for me. Bleed for me. Jesus is the only one who climbs up the mountain, not of Carmel, but Calvary. And says, I will go myself to the altar. And I will be slashed open for you. That's literally what happened on the cross. His blood was spilled. His side was pierced. And his death stood for yours. And that's what happens. That's the gift. That's the grace for anybody who trusts in him. So when we go to the Lord's Supper in a minute, that's what we're remembering. That's what we're recalling. Christ is powerful. Jesus is magnificent. One day he actually will wield fire. That comes though at the end. It hasn't happened yet. Everything gets consumed by the fire of the Lord eventually, but right now, in this time, in this place, he's the sacrifice. He triumphs through his death. It's his body given for us. It's his blood shed for us. That's how we live. We believe in the shed blood and in the broken body of Jesus. And where we've made idols, where we've chased after other things, where we've made other things a god, we confess it and we say, Lord, I know I deserve the fire. I know I deserve the slaughter. Thank you that you take that for me.
Our Savior is a congregation located in Wheeling, Illinois. Our vision can be summed up in four words: building community, bringing Christ. To learn more about this vision and our hope for our neighborhood, visit us online at osefc.org.